resume some catechism. What we were doing was, as we were memorizing the catechisms, I would try to, every month or so, catch us up, or a couple of months, do a couple of sermons on what we had been learning, explain what we've been learning, and then move on. But then we kind of got caught up in the Daniel study, and it seemed like there were enough other things breaking it up that I didn't want to break it up more. So now we're going to talk about the catechism, even though we're not really memorizing it. Now we're just reading it. We're taking a question and answer for a month. You're welcome to do the memorization, but we're not doing that as a church. But I thought we could just pick up where we left off. Just a reminder, why do we call it the Westminster Catechism? Well, it was a function of the Westminster Assembly. Some 60 to 80 divines, mainly Puritans, Presbyterians. They had some dissenters who might be of the Congregational Baptist types. And so this was, when you want to think the date, think around 1640-ish. And they got together over a period of time, and they produced what's called today often the Westminster Standards. There's a confession of faith. There's a shorter catechism, a longer catechism. There's a directory of worship, some directions on how to approach worship. And all those documents came out of it. So we have been addressing questions, thinking about the shorter catechism and using that as our guide, but also with a later influence. So if that's 1640s, about 200 years later comes along a fellow, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. And he took the Westminster Catechism and he adapted it somewhat, because one of the biggest areas that they had a problem in the Westminster Catechism is a strong emphasis on the Puritan, Presbyterian, Anglican influence. And so they had child baptism. And needless to say, that would be something Mr. Spurgeon rightly would have a problem with, as do we. So he modified a few things, kept as much as he could, with some modifications. So we have been guided by those two processes and have somewhat modified a little bit, but mainly gone pretty close to what Mr. Spurgeon did, who was pretty close to the Westminster.
The
Westminster Divines did the catechism.
Okay, the reason I ask that is it safe to assume, which I don't know the answer to, the London Baptist 1689, there was no catechism adjoining that, or was there?
The confession of 1689, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know.
If there is, I've never heard of it. So.
I can't think of it, but I don't want to say emphatically. Was there a baptism with the London Confession that came out 50 years later? I can't remember that there was. So, and that might have been something that would have influenced Mr. Spurgeon. So anyway, he put some work on it. We did. So two of the biggest concerns or differences we might have is we're clearer on the premillennial reign of Christ, or return of Christ. That's there tends to be a kind of an amillennial, postmillennial thrust, and of course the infant baptism. So probably the most important and familiar question is number one in the catechism, that if nothing else, this one you should get, okay? And the question is, what is the chief end of man? Let's say it together. Man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. Hugely well done thought as they think together, what is man all about? And so starts off with, what are we for? We're to glorify God and enjoy him. That's our purpose. Our purpose is not to become famous. Our purpose is not to become wealthy. Our purpose is not our comfort or our popularity. Our purpose is to glorify God and to enjoy him. So in other words, to glorify him, but the idea of enjoyment suggests we have a relationship with him. That's our goal. That was the first question. We've had a few, and I've kind of explained through it. I think you can find on our website the sermons that address the previous questions. We come up to question number 33, what is adoption? And adoption is we're thinking here of the biblical expression of it. Here's the question, what is adoption? This is described in the Bible. What's the answer? Answer, adoption is an act of God's free grace whereby we are received into the number and have a right to all the privileges of the sons of God. So you can see some elements in it. Again, it's God's gracious work. It's nothing we've earned. It's right with what we're talking about in the book of Romans. And the idea that God draws us and brings us into his family, that is an amazing blessing. It's one of the things that this is a section of the catechism that's just considering a portion of the riches we have in Christ and that he adopted us. One verse that's clear and pointing to that is John 1:12. But as many as received him, speaking of Christ, to them he gave the right or the authority to become children of God to those who believe in his name. What does it mean to receive him? He explains it to believe in his name. To those who believe in Christ, they're given the privilege of being sons or children of God. Again, if you're going to do a personal study on the catechism, if you're in a place where you're studying it for your own devotions, teaching it, one of the places that I would point you to is a creative source called shortercatechism.org or .com. I think if you type in .org, it'll take you to .com. And if you go there, it's the Westminster Shorter Catechism, slightly modified by because it's a Bible Presbyterian work, and they're even more Bible Presbyterians tend to be more sympathetic to a pre-mill view of eschatology. But anyway, that with each question, you click on a question, it'll give you the question, it'll give you their supportive verses, and then it'll give you links to half a dozen or more commentaries on the Shorter Catechism. So, you know, so you get all this great study. And I'm quoting some from some of the sources. And one of those is a source that, I don't know if we still have Thomas Vincent's. We're sold out. You missed your chance. So you have to go online if you want. But so he was one of the ones I liked. And he's a very helpful interpreter of the catechism. So the catechism was designed often with children and with Christian families in mind. Using a catechism to catechize is to teach by question and answer, and there would be this memorization process. And as you go through the question and answer, or we even just the reciting in the service, one of the goals is that it kind of tunes the ear of our heart and mind to sound doctrine. So when false doctrine comes along, it doesn't quite sound right. For example, you know, I'm not really mechanically inclined, and so I might turn on a car and I might just totally miss some, you know, where if you get a guy that's all into mechanics, you know, he turns on the engine, all of a sudden he's saying, you know, you've got a problem in the third cylinder. Do I have cylinders? You have cylinders, but you've got a problem in the third one. You know, something like that. Well, if you heard enough of it, you know what sounds right and what doesn't sound right. Well, so as we keep repeating and thinking about these questions and answers, it helps us think biblically, theologically. So if someone comes along from a cult and wants to challenge our thinking, there might be enough here that we recognize something isn't right here. And then you might remember, wait a minute, where could I get a good survey of biblical doctrine? The Shorter Catechism. Okay, so that would be, and so you might even say, wait a minute, I could try shortercatechism.org. And oh, there it is. And you might look through and see the topics. So that's just one, some of the reasons we're thinking here. Anyway, so Thomas Vincent does like a, you know, an explanation or a catechism in a sense on the catechism. So with the question that we started back here, adoption is an act of God's free grace whereby we are received into the number and have a right to all the privileges of the sons of God. So Thomas Vincent begins asking some questions. How many ways may we be said to be the children of God? Okay, first of all, are you comfortable with the fact that a Christian can be called a child of God? Okay. Well, let's think about that. What does that mean? And so he points out there's two ways that believers are a child of God. One, by regeneration. What's another word for, or another way of saying regeneration? Be born again. But born again, you know, that doesn't sound educated enough. You say regeneration, you sound sophisticated. It's the same word. So one, when we are born again, we are spiritually become children of God, but also by adoption. And that's sort of like another imputation. It is a legal act of God. So in two different ways, we are children of God, by spiritual birth and by adoption. And so he goes on to say, whereby we differ. Now, this makes us different, he says, from Christ, because he is God's son by eternal generation. And that's one of those concepts that's a little, you know, that the heretics have gotten worked up when it says, if he's the son of God, then that means he must have had a beginning. There was a time when he was, if you will, born. And so the biblical understanding is the sonship of Christ is an eternal relationship. And so they call it the eternal generation of the Son. Jesus is God's son as his part of his eternal relationship to the Father. Got that? So this is pretty heady stuff. Okay. And that's not even what we're talking about tonight. But just by contrast, Jesus isn't regenerated, right? He's not born again. He's not adopted as a son. He is God's eternal son. So we're different from him as a son. So he can tell us to pray to God, you know, Abba Father, our Father which art in heaven, things like that. But when he calls God Father, it is even a higher sense. But we're also different from angels who are also called the sons of God. A couple of verses here. How about someone look up the book of Job. Chapter 1, verse 6 to start us off. Job chapter 1, verse 6. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. No, wait a minute. If you can find Psalms, it's right before that. Job, someone have it? All right, Daryl.
You want me to read just that verse?
Just one verse, 1 verse 6. Okay. So the sons of God, Satan's with them, they're presenting themselves before the Lord. Skip over to chapter 38, verse 7 of Job. Job.
38:7. When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy.
Sons of God, here in Job, are referring to angelic beings. They're called sons of God in that they were created directly by God. There are no angelic grandbabies. You know, that's a problem, right? You have all the little greeting cards. Some, you know, half the angel population are cute little babies, right? Not so. They don't have babies. They are just all created by God. So in that sense, they are sons of God. Now, Thomas Vincent didn't mention something, but I'll add it too. He's saying, how is our sonship different? From Christ, he's eternally the Father. From angels, they were created directly. That their sonship is they were direct creations of God. Throw into that Adam. Someone read Luke chapter 3, verse 38. Luke traces the genealogy of Christ backwards. He doesn't begin with Abraham or David. He begins with Christ and goes backwards to the beginning. Luke chapter 3, verse 38. Here's what he says. Someone have that? Yes, sir, Mark. So tracking all the way to the last couple ones, so-and-so is the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so, son of Adam, son of God. In other words, he came, he didn't have a mother, father, he was created directly by, so he too is called the son of God by creation. Have I got us complicated enough? So all that to say, our sonship is different from the created sonship of Adam, the eternal sonship of Christ, and the created sonship of angels. That's what he's basically saying. What does that have to do with adoption? Not a lot, but it helps us just get a perspective. So then he talks about the question, well, let's talk about human experience. We talk about adoption, that means something to us. What is it when men adopt children? So before we talk about what it means in the divine perspective, what does it mean when men, human beings, adopt children? Men adopt children when they take strangers or such as are none of their children into their families and account them their children. Does that sound about right? Pretty good definition. and accordingly do take care of them as if they were your own, their own. Make sense? So when we went through our legal processes, and each time we went before the judge for the finalization, the finalization. You know, there's a whole bunch of processes, placement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The final thing where it's all legalized, and the judge goes through the process, and one of the things they'll say is, now you understand that when you do this, this child will be as much yours as if born to you. There's no distinction. Correct? Correct. But they take someone from outside the family, bring into the family as a full child with full standing. Now, in the ancient world, days of the New Testament, sometimes people would adopt someone who was an adult. And the Greek word for adoption literally means something like to place as a son. And so what that means is you might, if you needed an heir, you wanted an heir, or you wanted to raise someone to be your heir, you would adopt them, granting them the full privileges of a son, in other words, with full rights of inheritance and heirship. But the idea is taking someone from outside the family and bringing them in as if a child. So, Vincent goes on. We're still looking at Vincent here. What is it for God? If that's what it is for a human being, a man, a person to adopt, what is God's adoption? God doth adopt children. Hello there. You know, you can tell this is a little older. When he taketh them, which are strangers, and that qualifies for all of us, right? Like you couldn't get a stranger bunch than us. And by nature, children of wrath, into his family, and receiveth them into the number, and giveth them a right to all the privileges of the sons and daughters of God. So what is adoption? Strangers, but not just strangers, children of wrath. He brings them in with full privileges of as sons and daughters. Then he quotes some portions from Ephesians 2. Verse 3 starts with, we were by nature the children of wrath, even as others. Now, therefore, going into verse 19, you are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and of the household of God. So we were, God's adopting us as taking those who were strangers outside his family, brought into his family, those who were children of wrath to children of God. That's what adoption is. It's an astonishing thing. Let's go to another of the Puritan commentators, Thomas Watson. So he wrote what's called a body of divinity that is just an exposition, sermons preached on this doctrine. Or on the doctrines laid out in the catechism. Here's some things he said. I'm using them just because they said it so well, I think, that we can use that as our starting point. God, in adopting us, does two things. I love that about the Puritans. When a Puritan preached a sermon, the first thing they do is they do with the text. And they might call that observations. And there would be a careful grammatical analysis of anything significant of the text. Then they would go from observations, dealing with the text, to doctrine. They would derive principles from that. So they would start developing, and by now the sermon's getting into an hour and a half or so. And then there would be lessons, where there'd be all these implications of the theology that we've just discussed. But they love these lists. And back in those days, when everyone went home for fried chicken, they would talk about the firstly and the secondly and the thirdlies of the sermon. They would walk through the points that had been laid out before them. Well, so here, let's think numerically. Thomas Watson. God, in adopting us, does two things. One, he ennobles us with his name. He who is adopted bears the name of him who adopts him. I will write on him the name of God, my God. What's he saying here that God does with adoption? Give that in more familiar terminology. Pardon me? Yeah. And what a family to be a part of. And, you know, there's certain names that in certain, you know, groups just, you know, oh, you're that family. And so he ennobles us by allowing us to carry his name.
Could you go as far as to say that at the point of adoption, God says, he's mine.
Yeah.
He's mine.
And his name. And his reputation goes with us. But, yeah, what a privilege. I'm a child of God. So one thing he does is he ennobles us by giving us that child of God as our as name. Secondly, God consecrates us with His Spirit. So one, he puts a nice label on us. Can I put it like that? But He does more. When He adopts, whom He adopts, He anoints. Whom He makes sons, He makes saints. So He doesn't just give us a title. He gives us a transformation when He makes us His son. Then He goes on, when a man adopts another for his son and heir, he may put his name upon him, but he cannot put his disposition into him. If he be a morose, rugged nature, he cannot alter it. So if you can put your name legally on, but you can't transform the person. But whom God adopts, He sanctifies. He not only gives a new name, but a new nature. Well, let's read that. 2 Peter 1:4. Do you have it? I saw eyes up. Anyone? Yep. Partakers of the divine nature. So, in adoption, we can do a legal transaction. We can ennoble with a name, but we cannot transform a nature. He does that. Whom He makes sons, He makes saints. By the way, and that's the order. You know, He doesn't sanctify us so that we can become sons. You see what I'm saying? The sanctification is a lifelong process. You don't get to a certain point and say, ah, now you're my son. You're my son. And we've started the growth process. Well, He turns the wolf into a lamb. He makes the heart humble and gracious. He works such a change as if another soul dwelt in the same body. He makes a transformation in whom we are. So when God adopts us, He does what we cannot do in the human nature. He also works in our heart. When He makes us His child, it isn't just a legal declaration. It is a character transformation. Is it instantaneous? The name is. Is the transformation instantaneous? No, it's a growth process. And sometimes kind of stumbling and up and down, but it's a process. Watson goes on. To what does God adopt us? And there's a few labels He gives us. He had about six, I think. But anyway, He adopts us to a state of excellence. It were much for God to take a clod of dust and make it a star. It is more for Him to take a piece of clay and sin and adopt it for His heir. This is good language. So that's pretty impressive when God takes a piece of dirt and turns it into a, you know, create dust and then say, okay, I'll make that into a solar system. He says more impressive when God takes a sinful clod of dust and clay, a human being, and turns that person into His heir. God adopts us into a state of liberty. So one, a state of excellence, but then a state of liberty. Adoption is a state of freedom. A slave being adopted is a free man. So if you took a slave and adopted in your heir in the ancient world, they're no longer a slave. They have been brought into freedom. Your status is a freed man and your heir. God adopts us into a state of dignity. He makes us heirs of promise. He installs us unto honor. The adopted are His firstborn. They have angels for their lifeguards. They are of the blood royal of heaven. So what does He mean we have angels as our lifeguards? Maybe we should read. So in Hebrews 1:4. 1:14. Thank you for reading better than I can. Yes. Someone have that one?
Are they not all ministry
The angels are sent out to serve the heirs, the inheritors, the sons of salvation. Now think about that. In other words, whom he appoints to as our caretakers, our lifeguards. Maybe that'll change our perspective. So next time you hear the word lifeguard, don't think of someone with a really bad sunburn sitting up on a high chair. You know, think of an angel sent from heaven for the care of God's people. Okay, we'll stop there for now on that one. So one, God adopts us to a state of excellence. Tremendous transformation. A state of liberty, from the freedom from the bondage and penalty of sin, to a state of dignity. We have all these privileges as co-heirs. In fact, just amazing to me to think about the fact that we are heirs of God. And sometimes you might have to be careful how you pronounce that and spell that. Not E-R-R-O-R-S of God. H-E-I-R-S. Heirs, inheritors. That's an awesome thing to think about. Yes?
Would you mind kind of explaining again how, you know, Jesus is the firstborn, and then we're firstborn also?
Well, in other words, firstborn can be a sign, is a label of honor. So he is firstborn, even though he wasn't born. In other words, he is of the highest honor of all creation. We share his glory. And that's like Romans 8 is saying here. If we're the children of God, then we are his heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. In other words, in this case, if indeed we suffer with him, though we might be that we may also be glorified together. For example, in the kingdom, we will reign with Christ. We share in his inheritance. The kingdom is his, and we, the children of God, share in that royal kingship. It's amazing that we are. It's for me hard to comprehend that God raises us up from a dirty clod to co-heir with Christ. It's one of the incomprehensiblenesses of salvation, that he didn't have to do that. He could have just wiped us blank. He could have done so much, but he made us to share in the inheritance with Christ. You know, he wanted, in John 17, he's praying that we might share in his glory. He wants us to be with him. Galatians 4:17, therefore you are no longer slave, but a son. Remember, it's a transformation of liberty. And an heir through Christ. So an heir is someone who has a claim on the riches of the one who bestows. And so we with Christ are have a claim on the riches of God. The riches of the kingdom and the riches of glory. So that when we are among the angels of heaven, the word angel simply means messenger. They are messengers. We are children. And so if we were to go over to one of the palaces of Europe, where the royal family dwells, I imagine there are many servants who also dwell in the same building. But there's a world of difference of who they are. The royal family members are co-heirs. The others are servants. We are co-heirs. We have a claim on the glory. And as soon as you say that, someone said, we're not deserving. Who do we think? And that's the whole point. It's God's free grace. It's nothing we deserve. It's what we don't deserve. So Watson has some more meditations for us. The wonder of God's love in adopting us will appear the more if we consider these six things. That men should adopt us that God should adopt us when he had a son of his own. He already had a son. Men adopt because they want children and desire to have some to bear their name. But that God should adopt us when we had a son of his own, the Lord Jesus is a wonder of love. There's just a picture. Look at how many he adopted when he already had the perfect son. The wonder of God's love in adopting us will appear the more if we consider these six things. Number three in that list, that God should be at so great expense in adopting us. What did it cost him to adopt us? Yeah, his own son. Look what he did to adopt us. The wonder of God's love in adopting us will appear in that God should adopt his enemies. If a man adopts another for his heir, he will not adopt his mortal enemy. But that God should adopt us when we were not only strangers, but enemies is the wonder of his love. It's an amazing thing that he took pity on these desperate wretches, but not only desperate wretches, enemies. And he adopted us, raised us up to freedom, raised us up to bear his, ennobled us with his name, raised us up to have an inheritance in his kingdom. That wonder of God's love in adopting us will appear in that God should take great numbers out of the devil's family and adopt them into the family of heaven. Christ is said to bring many sons to glory. So what an amazing thing that God reached into the family of Satan. Because you think about the sonship. We talked about the sonship of an angel as created, the sonship of Christ as the eternal son, the sonship of Adam as created. We all are sons of Adam, and Jesus makes clear in John chapter 8, we're really sons of the devil. I've told you about the street evangelist I used to enjoy listening to at Berkeley, Holy Hubert. He had remarkable ways about him, and some of his expressions were great. You know, he'd start arguing with someone, and one of his little things after someone, he just had a big, blow up. Because that's what he did. He'd do that, and crowds would gather, and he'd preach the gospel. One of his phrases often was, "Bless you, dirty hearts." But if someone was going after him really bad, he'd say, "You're just being like your daddy. Your daddy's the devil. That's who your daddy is," and he'd launch into that. I learned some theology in some of those things, but God reaches into the devil's, because that's who we are outside of Christ. We are sons of Satan. And God blessedly reaches into Satan's family and draws from there into his family. Well, that's amazing, the grace that means. And so, Thomas Watson's saying, just wonder, will you, at adoption? The wonder of God's love in adopting us will appear the more if we consider these six things. Here's number six. That God should confer so great honor upon us in adopting us. David thought it no small honor that he should be a king's son-in-law. What is he talking about here? When he's going to marry Michael? Michael? Michael. Yeah, it's a strange, yeah. But he's marrying her, and or it's proposed to him to marry the David. Who's the father-in-law? Saul. That Saul wants to have you as a son-in-law. And he's like, who am I to marry into the royal family? I can't. And then they, if you kill 200 Philistines, then maybe you'll feel better about it. Okay, that I'll do. If I can kill 200 Philistines, I somehow earned the right to maybe be in the royal family. But you see, his perspective is like, who am I to be a son-in-law to Saul? Well, that's not such a great thing. So you see how much more then, if David thought it no small honor that he should be a king's son-in-law. Well, what honor to be the sons of the high God. So those are some. So if you're feeling kind of down and out or something, think about the fact that you've been adopted if you know Christ as Savior. Think about the love. And again, we start off with it's God's free grace, which of course is a redundancy. Grace is free. That's the whole point of grace, is that which is free. It's like a free gift as opposed to a gift you buy. That's a free grace. But the point is, it's God's, in his free love, his free will, he poured his grace on us, choosing us to be his own. And this is all that comes with it.
Recently I heard a man say, this is a man who claims to be Christian, said something about each of us having to become worthy of salvation. And I told him very quickly, we can never be.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah, the idea that you can be worthy. And that, but see, again, that's the world system.
Yeah.
That's, the theological statement is there's no such thing as a free lunch. Well, then there's no such thing as free heaven. Guess what? There is no free lunch unless you're in a federal program. And there is free heaven if you know Christ. It's free. Someone has paid for it. And then the other side of that is, however, Paul says, walk worthy since you have been brought in. And one of the pictures that comes to my mind, I think I've told the story, that one of the servants in the royal family saw the princesses of the queen being put into a car heading off to a party. And as they were, being loaded up, the queen said, remember who you are. And what she, in other words, and for the royal family, in theory, that means you're never off the clock. They're always watching. Live worthy of who you are. That's a good call for us. Remember who you are. Should a son of God be doing this? So, this is just a kind of a verse to think about. John himself is amazed. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. Just incomprehensible. Therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. So, no wonder we feel a little out of place in this world. He's out of place in this world. But if I'm rejected by the world, don't forget what manner of love that he's called me his child. He's given me into his inheritance. He's put his name on me. And even better, he's put his nature into me. And so this concept of adoption isn't just a word we quickly run over, that by his free will, he chose to adopt us. Ephesians 1:4 talks about the riches of that word are stunning. And we come back to that. What does it mean to be a co-heir with Christ? Phenomenal. One of the greatest titles Jesus has, Son of God. I'm a child of God. By adoption and regeneration. That's nothing to boast in. But we can boast in him. And so, behold, what manner of love. Yes. Adoption is more of a legal. I'm giving you the name and rights. Regeneration is I am actually changing your nature. I am spiritually bringing that dead cloth to life. And it's all part of the sonship, but two vital aspects in name and in nature, a son of God. And again, the struggle is, now, he does what human adoption can't. He instills his nature. But then it's a lifetime of trying to be like our father and not like our other father. So, okay. That's adoption. We'll come up with the next one. I think sanctification is our next question.